hppodcraft.com.
Mr. Barton, although he had latterly begun to earn for himself the character of an hypochondriac, was yet very far from deserving it. Though by no means lively, he had yet naturally what are termed even spirits, and was not subject to undue depressions. He soon, therefore, began to return to his former habits, and one of the earliest symptoms of this healthier tone of spirits was his appearing at a grand dinner of the Freemasons, of which worthy fraternity he was himself a brother. Barton, who had been at first gloomy and abstracted, drank much more freely than was his wont, possibly with the purpose of dispelling his own secret anxieties, and, under the influence of good wine and pleasant company, became gradually, unlike himself, talkative and even noisy.
That was the beginning of Chapter 4 of The Familiar by Sheridan Le Fanu, a story we've been talkative and even noisy about. We hope you're ready to engage in our pleasant company as we continue to talk about it, and we hope you are perhaps under the influence of some good wine. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey. And you're joining us here at the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're here at hppodcraft.com. Who was that reader?
That reader was Greg Johnson. Watch his Christmas video.
Christmas power?
Yes, it's freaking awesome. It's going to knock your socks off. I didn't know there was so much power in Christmas, but there seems to be enough to level a city.
It's been laid out for you all there. We will link out to it in our show notes. Check out Greg's video, Christmas Power. He's always lighting up the YouTubes with his comedic stylings. It's a cliche thing to say, but when I look at YouTube, I think, wow, this is really amazing. But I always also simultaneously think, I'm so glad this didn't exist when I was younger. How many dumb vampire movies would I have made when I was 14?
Oh.
Actually, I probably would have just made one because then people at school would have seen it and then I would have had to quit school and run away.
Right.
And I probably would have turned into a life of crime. Let's recap last week's show. You got mugged. I got cruised. Father Mulcahy inadvertently brought a man back from the dead in an episode of MASH. But in the actual story that we're covering, The Familiar, a middle-aged sea captain, retired to polite society and engaged to a beautiful young lady, finds himself being followed at night occasionally in one part of town. He's been receiving menacing letters from somebody signed The Watcher, and a dwarfish man has approached and given him some insanely dirty looks. From different things Captain Barton has said and done, we surmised that he thinks The Watcher is actually a fella named Sylvester Yelland, somebody he had trouble with at sea, whom he thought was dead, but it would somehow come back in a shrunken down version and is now intent on revenge. And this has, of course, made him very depressed, but no incidents have happened recently. He's been avoiding that street where he usually gets followed. And so, as we heard in the opening, his depression and his fear have lifted a bit.
You know, in the story where there is somebody that has been shrunken down to a smaller size.
Yes.
I can't help but think of that Wayans Brothers movie.
Oh, you're thinking about that movie, Little Man?
Yes. Little Man.
I haven't seen that one.
I have never actually seen it. I've seen the trailers to it, and it was horrific to me.
Yeah.
For some reason, when continuing to read the story and doing notes, I had thought about Little Man being this man.
Yeah, well, he asked earlier, is it possible for a man to be shrunken down? And I guess if you look at Little Man, the evidence is all there. Yes, it's possible.
It's all possible. So, Chapter 4,
right.
We get Barton going to Freemason's party, and he's getting his drink on. Mm-hmm. Then around 10:30, he decides to go over to Lady L's house to hang out with his betrothed, which I guess is the 18th century version of a booty call.
That's right. The booty call is a product of the Enlightenment. Everybody knows that.
Now he's not sloppy drunk, just feeling a bit buzzed. Of course, he could take a coach to go see his lady, but he decides he wants to walk it. He's feeling like he wants to face his fear. Mm. I guess he's feeling particularly drunk strong, and he decides that he's going to walk that street.
With his drunk strength, it seems like a good idea. But I think it's a terrible idea. By the way, you're familiar with the 1991, since we're talking about movies as well, you're familiar with the
sure.
1991 masterpiece, Beastmaster 2, Through the Portal of Time, right?
You and I watched it together right. In your parents' basement.
Back then, I think in 92.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful, wonderful movie. I had a hankering to watch it again recently. I haven't seen it since then. Mm-hmm. But it's not on Blu-ray. I don't know why. There's no streaming version of it that you can rent. But aha! The aforementioned amazing YouTube came to my rescue.
Ah.
The whole movie's on there. And it looks very VHS, but you can watch the whole thing. I really recommend get some folks together, put it up on the big screen. You will not be disappointed with this movie. Now, friend of the show, Michael Welchel, he's read for us before. He came over to watch it with me this past weekend. And all you really need to know is that the bad guy and the Beastmaster have traveled through a portal into quote-unquote modern-day Los Angeles. And the bad guy has absconded with some kind of neutron bomb. And in the third act, he decides to hide mm-hmm. from the authorities with the bomb by going to a zoo. There's a million things going on in this movie. For some reason, this I never thought of. Michael pointed out, you know, maybe if the guy, the one guy who's chasing you is the Beastmaster, going to the zoo is not the best move. The villain was really not making good choices in that moment. All of which is to say that our protagonist, very similarly, he's been followed on this particular street a few times. He's actually received a letter telling him, hey, you have reason to fear if you walk on this one street. And if you do that, you're going to be in trouble. Yet here he goes. He's going to walk on this street. Just like Archlon and Beastmaster 2, he's making foolish choices.
It all ties together, man.
It all ties together.
So he gets to the street and he's making his walk. Nothing happens. No footsteps or anything. So he's feeling pretty good until about 3/4 of his journey. And then blam! A musket fires, and a bullet whizzes past him.
Right by his head.
At first, he's going to go after this would-be assassin, but then he thinks better of it. You know, it takes about a minute to reload a musket. Mm. And I looked this up, and actually some soldiers could do it in 20 seconds.
Still a long time.
You know, if they got really good at it. But not feeling great about the odds, whether or not he can find the guy in 20 seconds, he decides that he's going to skedaddle. Mm. But also, because he's tough, he doesn't run. He just kind of makes his way very quickly.
Yeah.
Just then, the short guy in the hat, you know, the one that we've been talking about, the dwarfish dude.
The little man.
Comes walking by him and whispers, still alive, still alive. And then he just keeps going. Like, what the hell is going on?
Is he saying I'm still alive? Right? Because he was asking about a dead guy before. So he's boasting.
The way that it's described in the story, it also kind of sounds like he wasn't connected with the guy that shot at him. So did the little man get another guy to shoot at him?
Yeah, does he have associates? Because the gun went off from behind him, right?
Yeah, and he was up in front where he was walking. So it's like, is the implication that he's supernatural and somehow he was able to get in front of him from behind him?
Maybe he was just singing Stayin' Alive and they misheard it because they don't know that song. But yeah, he got shot at and then he saw the guy that presumably orchestrated it.
Right. So, of course, Captain Barton doesn't go to the police or tell anyone about this, and it's because he's probably hiding something.
Yeah, it says the true source of his sufferings and every circumstance connected with him, he guarded with a reserve so jealous that it seemed dictated by at least a suspicion that the origin of his strange persecution was known to himself, and that it was of a nature which, upon his own account, he could not or dared not disclose. He's got a deep secret, and that's really the reason. He feels responsible for this somehow.
Now, since Captain Barton is a man's man, he is keeping this all to himself. It's just that he doesn't want to burden anyone with his problems. So, of course, this secret that he's keeping is starting to eat him alive.
Just the way an animal would eat him alive if commanded by the Beastmaster, say. By the way, the title of this story is The Familiar.
Yeah.
Why? Is it because the little man is familiar to Captain Barton?
Is the implication about the owl at the end of the story?
Oh. Maybe that's what it is. Yeah, because I thought for sure we were going to get a witch's familiar, like a cat or an owl or a haunted rabbit or something like that. Hey, that's a good question. If Dar the Beastmaster were fighting a witch and the witch had a familiar, could Dar get the familiar to turn on her?
Well, I believe that witch's familiars are supposed to be devils or demons in the form of an animal.
Okay.
Not an actual animal. So I think Dar could not do that. Now, if a witch's familiar was just an intelligent cat, mm-hmm. then yeah, of course Dar could totally get in there.
All right. Well, thanks for solving that for me.
Yeah, just if you guys, anybody has any questions about the Beastmaster or Beastmaster 2 through the Portal of Time or even the television show, The Beastmaster, please just direct them to me.
Yeah.
I'll be more than happy to answer you.
Any theoretical Beastmaster conflicts that you can come up with, Chris can solve just like that.
I am Europe and North America's number one expert on Beastmaster.
You're the Beastmaster master.
I am the Beastmaster master, yes. Not in South America. There's this other guy, and he knows a lot.
He's the ST Joshi of Beastmaster Masters.
Exactly, yeah. And he lives in South America. But there's also this girl in Asia who is, she's at the top of her game.
Well, yeah, it's nice to hear that you have appreciation for your colleagues.
But if you're looking for somebody that speaks English and knows the most about Beastmaster,
yeah,
it is me. I know everything there is to know about Beastmaster.
You found it.
I found my niche. Anyway, Barton needs help, so he goes to a celebrated preacher, Dr. Blank, at his office. And I say Dr. Blank because it's one of these where they, you know, in these old stories, they wouldn't use people's names, yeah. I guess, to protect them. Barton beats around the bush a bit and tells the doctor, Dr. Preacher, that he's suffering and he needs help. Barton goes on to say that he doesn't believe in God or the supernatural, but stuff is happening that he just can't explain. And then Dr. Preacher, he says, oh, well, what you've had is what we like to call in the business a revelation. You've seen the light. But Barton is like, well, no, that's not it. I'm too set in my convictions, yet I do believe now, but sort of.
Like, I feel like I'm being attacked by demons. Ah, so you believe in God now, huh? Like, come on, man. Help me out.
Well, Dr. Preacher's advice for him is to get some exercise, join a gym, maybe get into Zumba. Barton says, Doc, I got no hope. I'm doomed and there's nothing I can do about it. Of course, the doctor tries to talk him down, but Barton is just not hearing it. He says, you don't get it. I've been a skeptic and my skepticism won't leave me, even though I'm being followed by a demon.
A demon in all caps. Demon.
Again, this is a little confusing. As I was reading this, I'm like, well, I don't understand what he's talking about. He's a demon. There you go. Now you believe. If you believe in demons, there's the thing. Mm. So Dr. Preacher tells him to pray, but he says that he's tried. And this is a response. The attempt only fills me with confusion and sometimes terror. I have tried in vain and more than in vain. The awful, unutterable idea of eternity and infinity oppresses and maddens my brain whenever my mind approaches the contemplation of the Creator. I recoil from the effort, scared. So is it like that he's under some weird hypnotic suggestion that won't let him pray?
No, I just think that the contemplation of things beyond what he has understood in the world so far fills him with a sort of existential terror. And so praying for him, you know, leads to that terror. So he just doesn't want to do it. I don't think there's anything that's keeping him from praying other than his own unfamiliarity with it.
He asks Dr. Preacher to pray for him since he can't, and the doctor agrees, and he tells Dr. Preacher everything that we know now so far from the story. Barton says that although he doesn't see the man in the flesh, he is haunted day and night, footsteps, cries in the distance, and then Barton stops talking, and he goes, did you hear that? And Doc says, yeah, it's the wind.
But the doctor did hear it. It says, the clergyman felt a chill of horror steal over him, while, during the wail of a sudden gust of wind, he heard, or fancied he heard, the half-articulate sounds of rage and derision mingling in the sough. But he says it's just the wind, to which Barton says, the prince of the powers of the air, which is how Satan is described in Ephesians. So for a skeptic, it seems like Barton does know quite a bit about the Bible.
Barton hints that the reason he knows the thing showed up when it did, but he won't tell us why. He just prays for mercy. He says, oh God, I fear, sir, you know not what you speak of. Mercy, mercy, heaven, have pity on me. Isn't that praying? Isn't that exactly what a prayer is, what he just did there?
I think all he was saying is, I'm not very good at it. Doctor, preacher, can you please pray on my behalf? The doctor doesn't really help him with very much,
yeah.
Other than telling him to go to that Zumba class. And when he leaves the office, I really don't think Dr. Preacher's going to do anything at all.
Thoughts and prayers, that's what it'll
be. Thoughts and prayers, sure. Same thing as doing nothing at all.
Jeez. You know, I like the idea better that somehow he wants to pray, but can't pray. Almost, he's like got some kind of supernatural curse on him that sort of blocked him from divinity.
Like he tries to put his hands together and he's like, I just can't.
Well, no, like he was saying, every time he tries to think about God and think, you know, like envision God and him praying and talking to God, that somehow the idea confuses him. You know, like he starts thinking of the cosmology of the universe and it just, he gets distracted by it and can't actually complete a prayer. I think I don't know. That's what I got out of it. And that to me is a little bit more interesting than him just being a skeptic, but not really a skeptic because he's telling him that this guy's a demon. So,
right.
Anywho.
I mean, certainly whatever this creature is, it's got some kind of power over. I mean, it's more than just a little guy.
Is it? I mean, well, let's talk about that at the end. Chapter 6, folks are starting to notice that Barton's malady, and there's talk around town that something's really wrong with him. What could it be? Who knows? Miss Montague and Lady L have noticed this as well, and they're hard at work gossiping about his problem.
Mm-hmm.
When General Montague, Miss Montague's dad, returns, he is over the moon about the marriage, and he poo-poos any criticism of Barton. The general has a sit-down with Barton and tells him that he's going to get rid of his blue devils. Barton tries to explain, but the general is not hearing it.
No, he's a man of action. He knows his Krav Maga.
The general is like, you know, let's grab this little fur-headed freak and beat the crap out of him. And Barton says, you don't get it. It's powers in here. And he points at his chest when he's saying that. to which the general wagers he'll have the short psycho captured in a matter of days.
He's not even scared. It's just math. He's going to get him. He says, I'll wager a rump in a dozen I call her the ghost and convince even you before many days are over. I had to look that one up. It's an Irish expression.
Oh.
You know, we are in Dublin. It means a rump of beef and a dozen of claret.
Hmm.
He's got confidence. He's going to be able to do it.
So Barton sees the dude out the window and he freaks out a bit.
Yeah, he looks out and says, there, by heaven, there, there.
The general looks and there he is.
It's the little man in the fur cap.
A general grabs his cane and he goes down after him. But of course, when he gets there, the menace is gone. Barton is surprised that he saw him. But despite the general's boasting, kicking this guy's ass, he's a little freaked out as well.
Yeah, he talks tough, but I think he just felt the menace of that fur cap.
Right. So Lady Ellen and the general persuade Barton to take a trip around the continent to ease his nerves. The issue is getting so bad that Barton is getting physically ill. And it's not that no one believes him. Everybody actually believes him. They just think that this jerk is a guy that's got a beef with him, not a ghost or a spirit, the way that Barton thinks it is.
Right. So if they leave, the guy will be stuck there and he'll at least get away from him. And that should do the trick. It's like being in a haunted house, though, and you know, or one of those films where it's like, hey, we'll just move and that'll do the trick, right? Wait a minute. It's followed me. I'm the one that's haunted, which he's already said. It's here. It's in my chest. So
it's in my chest.
I don't know if this is going to work out for him.
So chapter 7, Barton and the general goes with him on this. So I guess it's one of those weird things where he's getting to be better friends with his fiance's dad than his actual fiance.
Right.
It's a little creepy, you know, where he should be like hanging out with her all the time, but he's just hanging out with her dad. So Barton and the general go off on their tour, stopping first in England and then Calais in France. And this is really making Barton feel a lot better.
At first, but as they say, wherever you go, there you are.
They're walking in a busy area of the city and the general is stopped by a man that points out that he's going to lose his sick friend in the crowd. And then the general like looks and realizes that Barton's not there, turns and he's way back there and he's looking all pale and freaked out. And so he goes up to Barton and he says, you know, whoa, what's going on? And Barton says, I saw him, the guy. He goes, okay, where was he? And he goes, he came up, touched your arm and you talked to him. And he's like, what? That was the guy?
Yeah, what a mean trick.
Of course, the guy's long gone. Barton is hopeless, but the general is like, you know what? We're going to get that guy eventually.
Yeah, but Barton is resolved. He says, my friend, it won't do. With the faint voice and bewildered, ghastly look of one who had been stunned by some mortal shock. There is no use in contending. Whatever it is, the dreadful association between me and it is now established. I shall never escape. Never.
After that, Barton wants to return home. When they get back, there is Mini Shivago.
Oh, that's right. Mini Omar Sharif. That's what we were calling him. I forgot. Well, as soon as he returns to Ireland, they don't recount exactly what happens, but there he is in the crowd somewhere. He sees him immediately.
Barton is so freaked out that he's lost his will. Now he's just kind of ushered around by people that, you know, care about him. And,
yeah,
you know, he's just sort of like, almost like in a state of catatonia or something.
Right.
And they decide to keep him home or in well-guarded places. So he won't be in touch with any of the public.
Yeah, they don't want him to see outside. They don't want him to see the road. It's just the house, people he knows.
They hope that will pull him out of his malady.
It's like a werewolf solution a little bit. You know, seems to be a problem here, so let's just lock him up. If he stays at home, he can't get picked on by Mini Omar Sharif.
Well, it works for a few weeks, and then he gets better, and then a month goes by with no sign of the little jerk.
Yes.
Anyway, Lady L sends out her housekeeper to collect some herbs in the garden. She comes back with the job only half done and a scary story, which is chapter 8.
Uh-oh.
As the housekeeper was getting her herbs, she hears a super scary laugh. She looks up through the hedges and sees Little Jerk. His menace scares her so bad that she can't move. And he tells her to tell Captain Barton that he had better come out in public or he'll show up in his house. Lady L tells her, you even thinking about telling Barton and I'll fire you.
Yeah, that story is not something that he should hear. And let's just keep it from him. It looks like the guy is onto this whole stay-at-home plan. Mm-hmm. He's frustrated that Barton's not leaving, but nothing can keep him from wrecking vengeance. And so he's coming.
Right.
He's going to come get him one way or the other. He's a lot like Arklon, the bad guy from Beastmaster 2. Because at one point, Arklon says, he who defies Arklon shall be destroyed. By Arklon. This is essentially the same thing.
So Barton is out on a walk in the gated gardens, and guess what? Through the shrubs and the fence, he sees the guy and he faints. They find him a few minutes later and they bring him in, and he's not scared this time. It says, an unearthly tranquility reigned in his mind. It was the anticipated stillness of the grave. He tells the general that his troubles will soon be over. The general says, oh, that's great. What a relief. But Barton says, no, I'm going to be dead soon. The general insists that this guy is just a little jerk with a grudge and he's messing with him. Barton doesn't believe that and insists that it's some kind of cosmic retribution.
And even though he's at peace with death, he knows that there will be one more horrifying encounter.
If death could come without the dreadful sight I am doomed to see, I would gladly close my eyes this moment upon the world. But though death is welcome, I shrink with an agony you cannot understand, an actual frenzy of terror from the last encounter with that demon who has drawn me thus to the verge of the chasm and who is himself to plunge me down. I am to see him again, once more, but under circumstances unutterably more terrific than ever.
So Barton tells about waking up after passing out from seeing the man, and he had a vision or a dream, and he was on the shore of a lake surrounded by mountains, and his head was on the lap of a girl who was singing softly to him, and then it faded and he woke up. After telling this, Barton wept again loudly and bitterly.
So there's some woman, I think, that he hopes to see?
Yeah.
Perhaps from some doomed romance or something?
The barn becomes hidden away and on guard again.
And then we get to chapter 9. It's called Requiescat. I imagine a reference to Requiescat in pace, rest in peace.
Mm.
This is going to be the end of things for Captain Barton.
So obviously the wedding has been called off. Miss Montague, she doesn't give up on him. She spends a lot of time trying to cheer him up, but nothing seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
So now we get a fact. Seems that Miss Montague has a pet owl. That seemed kind of out of nowhere to me when it popped up in the story.
Yeah.
I guess she's kind of like Timothy Hunter, you know, that she has this owl with her all the time. You know how I didn't say Harry Potter there. I said Timothy Hunter, who is the character from Books of Magic that predates Harry Potter.
You hate Harry Potter.
You know, about the orphan boy with glasses. You remember? Who's got an owl, who's, you know, secretly a wizard. Remember that? Books of Magic.
Well, as a result of Harry Potter and that owl, a lot of people have tried to have owls as pets. It's not a very good pet.
No.
They are birds of prey. They're wild animals. I don't think you want to have one of those
in
your house. They're nocturnal.
Yeah.
You know, you need to feed them dead mice and rats and things like that. It's
a bad idea.
Not a good decision to keep in your house. Right?
And Barton seems to hate this owl. He goes nuts when it's around.
Which doesn't seem unreasonable to me, given what I just said.
The Reverend, our narrator of this whole thing, then gives an account.
Yes, of the last scene in this strange series of incidents. This is the kind of final scene in the story.
It's 2 a.m, and Barton wakes up, and he wakes up his servant slash handler, and he says, I can't get it out of my head that accursed bird has got out somehow, and it's lurking in some corner of the room. I've been dreaming about him. Get up, Smith, and look about. Search for him. Such hateful dreams.
Barton's been keeping the servant with him at all times because he's convinced that if he's alone, the watcher will come for that fatal final meeting.
Right.
So as long as he's got somebody with him, he's safe.
The servant goes to check it out. When he leaves the room, the door behind him slowly swings closed, presumably due to the wind.
Aha, but see, it's probably due to the powers of this little man. So he is more than just a little guy.
Or he just somehow closed it, like by walking up and closing it. The servant hears Barton freaking out in the room, but he can't get the door open.
Over the door, there's this small window, and he sees the candle moving across the room, or the light shift because somebody has lifted it and is moving over to the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows Barton is in that bed. He knows Barton didn't leave that bed.
Mm-hmm.
So who's moving the candle? It was actually a pretty cool way to lay that scene out.
Right.
It was a cool effect.
So he runs down the hall, and he finds General Montague. The servant says that he's sure Barton is dead.
Montague immediately rushes to the room.
The door opens, just opens up easy this time, and the owl flies out over their heads and down the hall. And when it flies past them, it blows his candle out.
Well, the owl does more than that. It says, the owl then crashed through the skylight that overlooked the lobby and sailed away into the darkness of the outer space. It's like a dramatic exit.
Into the darkness of outer space, too. It
exactly.
Of Earth's orbit. And just
it left the planet.
Had some space mead and it was on its way. The curtains on the bed are closed, and the servant notes that the candle has moved places. The general draws back the curtain and finds Barton dead, clutching his bedclothes. The servant notes that there is an indentation at the other end of the bed, indicating that someone else was there.
Oh, dear.
Of course, no clue was discovered as to what happened in that room. No further insight is provided, except, of course, a bit more detail about the past.
It appeared that some 6 years before Captain Barton's final return to Dublin, he had formed in the town of Plymouth a guilty attachment, the object of which was the daughter of one of the ship's crew under his command. The father had visited the frailty of his unhappy child with extreme harshness and even brutality, and it was said that she had died heartbroken. Presuming upon Barton's implication in her guilt, this man had conducted himself towards him with marked insolence, and Barton retaliated this and what he resented with still more exasperated bitterness, his treatment of the unfortunate girl, by a systematic exercise of those terrible and arbitrary severities which the regulations of the Navy placed at the command of those who are responsible for its discipline. The man had, at length, made his escape while the vessel was in port at Naples, but died, as it was said, in a hospital in that town of the wounds inflicted in one of his recent and sanguinary punishments. Whether these circumstances in reality bear or not upon the occurrences of Barton's afterlife, it is, of course, impossible to say. It seems, however, more than probable that they were, at least in his own mind, closely associated with them. But, however the truth may be as to the origin and motives of this mysterious persecution, there can be no doubt that, with respect to the agencies by which it was accomplished, absolute and impenetrable mystery is like to prevail until the day of doom.
And that's the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Other than a postscript reminding us that this account is included in the papers of Dr. Hesselius, the book's wraparound protagonist.
Right.
But that's just a short little note. So this is what I understand from that ending. And tell me if you got the same thing.
Yeah.
Captain Barton was getting it on with the daughter of one of his ship's crew members.
Mm-hmm.
That crew member beat the daughter when he found out about this, and she died.
Mm-hmm.
Crew member blamed Barton for it and was insubordinate to him. Barton reacted by taking him out and having him whipped and beaten Navy style.
Mm-hmm.
The dude escaped, but died.
Lockjaw.
He thought. But really, he somehow shrunk down and he came for his revenge.
I think so, yeah. And I think that in his vision of his head in the lap of the woman that was singing to him by the lake, I think that was her. I think it was the guy's daughter that had died.
Was the owl affiliated with the guy, or was the guy actually turning into an owl, like a familiar?
A familiar is a demon that takes the form of an animal. So it would, if it's a familiar, then it's an accomplice of some kind. Or maybe that's what happened with this dude, is that he did die, or he was dying, and he made a deal with the devil. I want to come back and have revenge, and if you help me, then I'll, you know, you can have my soul or whatever it is. But part of him being brought back was that he was, you know, smaller. One of the drawbacks to being brought back from the dead or from the brink of death,
right,
or whatever. I don't know.
Maybe it was the owl that shot that musket earlier.
Could have been the owl.
It would have helped to sort this all out if the owl actually had a little fur cap. Then we would know. We'd go, oh, it's the guy.
Yeah, some of these stories are just too subtle, you know?
Put a fur cap on that owl. Spell it out. But Barton, so I understand that Barton was violent with this guy,
uh-huh,
but the guy kind of had it coming. He beat his daughter to death.
Oh, hell yeah.
So Barton didn't really sin that badly, I don't think.
Well, maybe he was feeling bad because of his involvement with her got her killed.
Right.
Not directly, obviously. It was this guy, you know, her crazy father killed her. He's the one to blame, but he still feels some responsibility for it.
Right, like somehow they went about it inappropriately.
Yeah.
And that's what led to all of this misery.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Overall, I liked the story, though. I mean, I had a good time reading it. Did you?
Yeah, I did, too. It's really crazy.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Crazy's never a problem with me, though.
No. I like crazy because it's different.
Yeah.
This doesn't really fit the typical weird fiction mold. Usually, you don't have spectral dudes hiring gunmen to shoot at people. It's very weird. I don't get it. Yeah.
It's strange. Yeah.
I don't really know what's going on because it really seems like he's an actual physical dude.
Yeah, I think he is.
He doesn't do too much supernatural shenanigans. You know, he doesn't like walk through walls. He doesn't just vanish, and he can't get into the house. So he has to try and trick that poor housekeeper. It's like, you better tell him to come out or I'm going to come in there. Like, no, you're not. Can't get in here. You're just a little dude. I bet, of course, he could get in there.
There might be something we're missing, too. Sometimes we get that, you know, there's just a piece of research we didn't do. Somebody's going to write in and say, oh, you completely ignored the Irish legend of the owl that comes and saves dying men and turns them into dwarves so they can have their revenge, you know. There might be some simple thing that we don't know about. I mean, we were saying when we were reading that scarecrow story,
yeah,
why would he turn into a scarecrow? But it turns out there's all sorts of legends about people doing that. That, you know, if you'd lived in that country in time, it might have been more familiar to you. So maybe somebody, some Irish person can tell us if that's This is something common in their literature.
Let's bring up another big thing that we missed when we covered The Werewolf of Paris.
Oh, yeah.
Based on a real guy.
Yeah, there was an actual person that the book was based off of. Yeah, in four episodes of that, somehow we didn't include that there was a guy, Sergeant Francois Bertrand, who was disinterring and mutilating bodies in Paris cemeteries around the time.
Yeah, 1878, he was known as the Vampire of Montparnasse. He was a sergeant in the French army, and he was arrested in 1849, necrophilia, and jailed for 1 year.
The term necrophile was coined from his case.
Yeah.
So yeah, we missed out on that. Maybe we're missing out on something here. I don't know.
Yeah, we're just a couple of guys. We do our best, but man, there's a lot of research to do on these. And so, you know, we do appreciate people writing in and telling us what we missed. Please do.
Always.
And usually we'll come correct and share whatever great information we get.
The only thing, and I think we've established this well in this episode, there is a measure of expertise on here is Beastmaster.
Yes.
How he would resolve different situations he might find himself in. Mm-hmm. It's something that Chris is, you know, the North American master of. So.
And Europe.
And Europe, yeah. The English-speaking world knows you as the Beastmaster Master.
Well, I've earned it. I want to thank Greg Johnson for being the most awesome person of all time.
Excellent reader, at least I'll say that. He did a great job on this story. Always great to have him on the show. And please go check out Christmas Power. It's hilarious.
It is hilarious, but you can also download it from Bandcamp and iTunes, so you can add it to your favorite Christmas playlist. It will bring hours of joy to all that hear it.
Hey, next week. Kind of excited.
Yes, it's going to be another two-parter. This one is picked by somebody that supported us on our trip to Providence this year, and I'm very excited about reading it. We've been anticipating it for quite some time. It is Who Goes There?
Right, by John W. Campbell. We have referenced it tons of times.
Yes.
Obviously, we were talking about At the Mountains of Madness, but I feel like it's come up a lot.
Yeah.
The Thing is based on this story. Mm-hmm. Sounds like it'll be a good winter holiday story for us to close out on.
It sounds great to me.
I've actually never read it, and I've been dying to because I love those two film adaptations.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. So we'll be back with that next week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.